Sex and hypocrisy seem to go to bed together far too often. This is by no means confined to religious people. Most of our society seems somewhat unable to handle sex with honour and freedom, but Christians have a particularly bad record. The recent Royal Commission has meant that our newspapers have had a couple of years' worth of stories about sexual abuse and cover-ups of sexual abuse perpetrated by religious leaders, who were at the same time loudly preaching hardline traditional sexual morality. The Willow Creek Church in the USA, one of the biggest and most influential Baptist churches in the world, is currently struggling with the fallout of finding that their founding pastor has been sexually harassing staff members. Hypocrisy and sex seem to go to bed together far too often. The Roman Catholic Church is again copping bad press this week after releasing their response to the Royal Commission's recommendations. All the press attention has been on the one recommendation that they wouldn't accept, lifting the seal of confession in cases of child abuse. In practice, it's actually a bit of an irrelevance because disclosures of abuse in confession are almost non-existent, but the church has again left themselves looking defensive and hypocritical. Hypocrisy and sex seem to go to bed together far too often. If you were to listen to some Christians, you could easily find yourself thinking that human sexuality was beyond redemption and that the less we have to do with sex, the closer to God we will all be. Well, how do they explain then the presence of the Song of Songs in the middle of the Bible? The bit that Paul read to us in his sexiest voice tonight was not actually as racy as some of the rest of it. I do know how they usually explain it. They say that it's not sexy at all, that it's just an allegory of God's loving relationship with the church. And it is probably true that it was kept in the Bible because of this allegorical use, but the fact remains that it is first and foremost a collection of highly erotic love poetry. And it seems to me that if God didn't like that sort of thing, then it wouldn't have been used to illustrate the way God relates to us. But God, as the original author of human sexuality, must cringe when stories of sexually predatory church leaders keep hitting the news again. How do we get it so wrong, so often? Jesus' harsh words about hypocrisy in the gospel reading that we heard tonight focus on things to do with food rather than things to do with sex. But you may have noticed that the list of evils that he uses when he sums up his comments, the evils that he says come not from external influences but from the depths of the human heart, that list included fornication and adultery. Sex may not have been the primary topic of the debate on that day, but when thinking about religious hypocrisy, sex came readily to his mind. Much of the way that Christians have often thought about sex has been shaped by the mindset of the Greek philosophers that were influential at the time of the early church and which actually still have a lot of influence today. Greek philosophy had a tendency to divide spirit and flesh and to think of them as being in conflict with each other. And this was responsible for our tendency to think that sexuality and spirituality are at odds with one another. But the Hebrew prophets and poets didn't think that way. And that's why we so often get startled when we hear them using sexy talk to describe the things of the spirit. Actually, often we don't hear it because often the English translators have kind of cleaned it up so that we don't notice. But there's a lot of erotic imagery in the Hebrew scriptures, not just in the Song of Songs. It seems to have come rather naturally to them. If you wanted to describe the extraordinary depth of God's desire for intimacy with us, what other language could you use but the language of the most passionate human desire for intimacy, the language of sex? Christian understanding of God emerged primarily from the Hebrew understanding of God. Right at the beginning of the Christian understanding of God is what we call the incarnation, God becoming flesh. And at the culmination of Christian thinking about God is the resurrection, the human body restored and glorified. Christian thinking then must always remain incarnate. That is to say, it must always remain embodied, fleshly, earthy. Any spirituality that sees human bodily needs and desires as either irrelevant or as an obstacle to spiritual growth has dubious claims to be consistent with the teaching of Jesus. Any spirituality that sees sex as a problem to be overcome is getting itself seriously out of step with the way of the God made flesh. A friend of mine who is a gay Roman Catholic priest who has been living in Rome for about 3 decades, I once asked him if he could explain for me the apparent hypocrisy of the Roman Church's increasingly strident denunciations of homosexuality and their insistence that they were purging it from their midst, when, as my friend and I know, the prevalence of gay men among the Roman priesthood, the church hierarchies and the theological colleges is such that if they were to purge them all, it would bring the church crashing down in a very short space of time. A very high percentage of the really good Roman priests and theological academics I know are gay men. And the fact that I know that tells me that if the Inquisition was serious, they wouldn't have any trouble knowing it either. My friend's answer was very illuminating. As an Anglo living in Rome, he said that you have to realise that these fierce edicts come from within a Mediterranean culture, which has a very non-Anglo attitude to rules. He says that there isn't actually any expectation from the people making these statements that anyone is going to take any notice of them. Now, I'm an Anglo, so I don't really get that at all. It just sounds like hypocrisy to me. But he's lived in Rome long enough that I'm willing to take his word for it that that's not the way it's seen in that culture. But when I pushed him further, he acknowledged that the real problem comes when these pronouncements take effect in the Anglo world, in Australia and America and Britain, because they don't translate cross-culturally. And so we end up with much more dangerous, repressive consequences. You repress something as powerful as sex, the results can be explosive. The level of hypocrisy that has hidden outrageous and sometimes systemic sexual abuse, it's now costing the church billions of dollars, and yet it's still floundering in its attempts to face up to the causes. Tonight we heard Jesus' fierce condemnation of abandoning the commandments of God and holding to human traditions. And we've often been taught to hear that as a criticism of religious traditions and rituals. But if you read it fairly, that's not actually where the focus falls. What Jesus has in his sights are those who make a display of meticulously complying with the ceremonial practices, but who are up to their eyeballs in evil, in abuse, in exploitation and injustice. The Apostle James was aiming at the same target in the extract that we heard from his letter tonight, those who talk the religious talk but violate the ethics of love in their treatment of the vulnerable. A sexual ethic of just say no has been disastrous in its relational and pastoral consequences. And it also does no justice to a God who created sex and smiled and said it was good. But negative attitudes to sex have so infected Christian thinking that we start hearing just say no even when it's not there. Let me give you an example from another bit of ancient Hebrew poetry. In Proverbs chapter 5, there's a passage that is advising men against adultery. And if you were to read it in some of the rather sanitized modern translations, you could very easily hear it as, just say no, it's not good for you. But the original, if I can translate it a little bit more literally without kind of censoring it, the original is closer to this. Drink water from your own reservoir and running water from your own spring. Should your fountain overflow in the street and your water brooks in the public square, let your fountain be blessed and have joy from the woman of your youth, the hind of many loves, the gazelle with gracious favours. Let her breasts inebriate you at all time, her love constantly ravish you. For why should you be ravished by a stranger and embrace the bosom of another woman? Now that's a long way from just say no. It is more along the lines of, sex is like champagne. Why would you splash it around like cordial? Basically, it's advising against adultery on the grounds that the sex will be a lot hotter if you stick with one partner and don't have to keep starting all over again trying to figure it out from scratch with a new partner. It's an argument that values and celebrates great sex, even promotes it, instead of fearing it and trying to repress it. Sex is far too powerful and wonderful a thing to be held down by repressive attitudes. Almost invariably, attempts to control it by squashing it succeed only in forcing it into the dark, where it mutates and distorts and becomes a destructive and malevolent force that diminishes us and dehumanizes us. Vociferous campaigns against sexual sins are all too often masks of extreme hypocrisy that hide a dangerous, seething brew of obsessive sexual dysfunction. It is sex's great power for good that, when mistreated and distorted, gives it its power for evil. But the answer to that is to restore and celebrate its goodness, not to further repress it. Unfortunately, though, the culture around us has too often responded to one evil with another. Reacting against the repression of sex, we have splashed it around like cordial. We've commercialized it and trivialized it and turned it into a cheap, disposable consumer commodity. We've turned it into a social media competition in search of the most likes. And that doesn't liberate sex at all, let alone liberate us. Rather, it turns sex into a joyless nightmare that traps us and dehumanizes us and fills us with anxiety and fear and self-loathing. And for any of you who have been victims of malevolent and abusive sex, listen to the words we heard Jesus say tonight. Listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside of a person that by going in can defile. That is to say that nothing that anyone has done to you has defiled you in the eyes of God. God still looks upon you with love and joy and with tears of solidarity for your pain. You are not defiled. You are still the apple of God's eye. Sex was never meant to be like that, and God is not blaming you. The The Song of Songs is a collection of deliciously sexy poems that are included in our Bibles first and foremost as a celebration of one of God's wonderful gifts to us, the gift of sexual intimacy. And perhaps they are also there to remind us that sex is a precious gift to be honoured and celebrated and not disparaged by those who love God or trivialised and degraded by anybody. And the way that this erotic poetry has been used allegorically down through the years makes use of its unabashed passion to tell us something important about God, about God's feelings for us. The Bible is not at all embarrassed to use highly erotic literature to lead us into a greater understanding of God. We could even describe it as a sacramental view of sex. The God who takes flesh among us and who uses physical things to connect with us is happy for loving, faithful, joyous, and passionate sexual intimacy to be for us a taste of the nature of God, a glimpse of heaven. Liberated from hypocrisy and rescued from being splashed around like cheap cordial instead of treated with honour, the message of the Song of Songs is that sexual intimacy is not only a wonderful thing, but something through which we can be drawn a little more deeply into the exquisite mysteries of the God who is breathtakingly passionate love. Something very sacred indeed.